from him. He used to turn up and demand money. It was really blackmail, I suppose. If I didn't give him the money, he threatened to shoot himself. Then he took to threatening to shoot me.
Here you are, Freddy.
Thank you, Jimmy. I suppose it was he who shot Maggie Buckley. He probably thought it was me. I ought to have told you, Monsieur Poirot, but I couldn't be sure. And then, a few days later, when I saw...
You saw the scrap of his blackmailing letter on my table.
And I knew that it was only a matter of time.
My dear, my dear.
I'm all right now, Jimmy. What had we better do?
Don't look at me, madam. I'm merely obliging an old friend. That's all I'm doing.
Mr. Poirot, can't we just hush it all up?
You wish that, mademoiselle.
Well, I'm the person most concerned. There will be no more attacks on me now.
No, that is true. There will be no more attacks on you.
And nothing can ever bring poor Maggie back to life again. Well, if you make all this known to the outside world, you'll only bring an awful lot of publicity and suffering on Freddy. And she hasn't deserved it.
So you want to hush it up, mademoiselle. And what about you, Hastings?
I agree.
Mr. Lazarus?
Yes, hush it up.
Commander Challenger?
Best thing to do.
Let's forget everything that's passed in this room tonight.
I don't think anyone was asking you, Mr. Merton, nor Millie here.
Ellen?
I won't say a word, sir. Least said, so dismanded.
And you, Mr. Vice?
You just can't hush up a thing like this.
Charles, think of poor Freddy.
I'm sorry, my dear, but the facts have to be communicated to the proper quarter.
5-1. And the good chap is neutral.
I'm on holiday.
So, only Monsieur Weiss declares himself on the side of law and order. You are a man of character.
The position is clear. There is only one course possible.
And I too arrange myself on the side of the minority. I too am for the truth.
But Mr. Poirot...
Mademoiselle, you dragged me into this case. You cannot silence me now. Sit down, all of you. And I will tell you the truth. I have here a list of persons I believed connected with the crime. I numbered them with the letters of the alphabet, A to F, and then I added the letter X for a person unknown. I did not know who X was until tonight, but I suspected that there was such a person, and I was right. But a day ago, I suddenly realized that I must add another letter to my list. Let us call it Y.
Another person unknown?
Not exactly. It stands for a person who should have been included in the original list, but who was overlooked. Reassure yourself, Madame Rice. It was not your husband who shot Maggie Buckley. It was the person designated as Y.
Then who is why?
Chief Inspector.
Acting on information received, I took up a position in the house earlier this evening, having been secretly introduced into the place by Mr. Poirot. On his advice, I concealed myself behind the curtains in the drawing room. When everyone was assembled in the dining room to hear Mr. Vice read out the will, a young lady entered the drawing room and switched on the light. She made her way to the fireplace and opened a small recess in the panelling.
The secret hiding place.
She took from the recess a pistol. With this in her hand, she left the room and made her way to the hall where the visitors had left their coats on arrival. She carefully wiped the pistol with her handkerchief and placed it in the pocket of her grey coat, the property of Mrs. Rice.
It's a lie. Every word of it.
Voila. It is Mademoiselle Nick who is the person Y. And it was Mademoiselle Nick who shot Maggie Buckley.
You've gone mad. Why on earth would I want to kill Maggie?
In order to inherit the fortune left to her by Michael Seaton. For her name, too, was Magdala Buckley. And it was to her that he was engaged, not you.
That's nonsense. You can't possibly prove it.
You telephoned to the police, Chief Inspector Shap?
Yes, that should be them arriving now. They've got the warrant.
You've all gone stark, staring mad.
If you would kindly come with me, Miss Buckley.
Doesn't look as if you're giving me much option. Freddy, give me your wristwatch. As a souvenir, will you?
My wristwatch? Yes, here you are.
Thanks. And now, since you're so convinced that I am a murderess, Mr. Poirot, and since the Chief Inspector has a police van waiting outside, I suppose we must go through with this ridiculous comedy.
A comedy that you yourself devised, Mademoiselle. But you should not have given the star part to Hercule Poirot. That, Mademoiselle, was your grave mistake. And now, the comedy. It is finished.
The Crofts, too, were taken away, escorted by Jap. The rest of us, Frederica, Lazarus, Challenger, Weiss, and myself, moved into the drawing room. Poirot looked round at us with a gratified smile and that air of mock humility that I knew so well.
Eh bien, mes amis, I was fooled. Completely and absolutely. I confess it. The little Nick, she had me where she wanted me, as your idiom so well expresses it. Ah, Madame Rice, when you told Hastings that your friend was a clever little liar, how right you were. Her stories were invented, very cleverly, to arouse the interest of Hercule Poirot.
But why?
To give the impression that Mademoiselle Nick's life was in danger. At the start of this whole affair, we have this young girl, Nick Buckley, beautiful, unscrupulous, and fanatically devoted to Enthouse.
As I told you at our first meeting.
And I, very foolishly, I admit, did not believe you. But Enthouse was mortgaged. It was falling to pieces, and she had no money to do anything about it. And then she meets the young aviator, Michael Seaton, and he is immediately attracted to her.
He certainly was.
She knows that in all probability he is his uncle's heir, and that Sir Matthew Seaton is worth millions. But Michael Seaton is not really in love with her. He thinks her good fun, that is all. They meet at Scarborough. He takes her up in his flying machine. And then the catastrophe occurs.
One day she brought Maggie along with her.
And he falls in love with her at first sight. Nick is dumbfounded. But to young Seaton, Maggie was different. The only girl in the world for him. They became secretly engaged. And only one person was permitted to know.
And that was Nick.
She gets to know that Michael Seaton proposes to leave everything to Maggie Buckley. She pays little attention to it at the time.
And then she heard of Sir Matthew's death. And immediately after that, Michael Seaton's plane goes missing.
Straight away, an outrageous plan comes into our young lady's mind. Seaton only knows her as Nick. He does not know that she, too, is named Magdala. His will is very short and informal. He leaves everything to Magdala. And in the eyes of the world, Michael Seaton is Nick's friend. If she were to claim to be engaged to him, no one would be surprised. But if her plan is to succeed, Maggie must be eliminated. Time is short. She arranges for Maggie to come and stay in a few days' time. But then a major new factor comes into play. She reads in the local paper that I am staying at the Majestic Hotel.
You mean she really knew who you were?
Of course she knew, Hastings. Oh. Everyone has heard of Hercule Poirot. I believe in the peril that menaces her, and I play into her hands by asking her to send for a friend. She seizes her chance. She does not reveal that Maggie has already been invited. She asked her to come a day earlier than has been arranged.
So that she would be at Enthouse with a fireworks party, where nobody would notice the sound of a gun going off.
Exactly. And how easy the crime is to arrange. On the night of the party, Nick is wearing black. Fool that I was, I concluded that she was in mourning, but it was because she had to be dressed exactly like Maggie. When everyone is outside watching the fireworks, Maggie begins to feel cold.
Yes, it did get awfully chilly.
The two women go back into the house, but Maggie cannot find her coat because Nick has hidden it, and it is easy to persuade her to wear the crimson shawl. As Maggie leaves the house, Nick steals out after her and shoots her, and then goes back inside to hide the pistol in the secret panel. and waits until she hears the sound of voices outside.
I'm sorry I've been so long, Maggie. I couldn't find my... What is it? What's happened? Maggie! Oh, Maggie!
How well she played her part. Magnificently. Oh, yes, she staged a fine drama there. Ellen said that this was an evil house, and I fear that she is right. It was this house which drove Mademoiselle Nick to take her cousin's life.
But the poisoned chocolates, were they the ones I sent her?
It was all part of the comedy. If Nick's life was attempted again after Maggie's death, everyone would be more convinced than ever that the shooting was a mistake.
So once we were out of the way, she simply rang you up, Mrs. Rice, and asked you to send her a box of chocolates.
And when it arrived, she filled certain chocolates with cocaine.
You mean to say that she actually had cocaine with her?
Madame Rice?
Oh, yes, she had cocaine.
She eats just one of the chocolates. She knows very well how much cocaine to take and just what symptoms to exaggerate.
But what about the card from you?
Ah, Savristi, she has a nerve. It was my card, the one I sent with the basket of carnations.
Ah.
So simple, and I fell for it.
Why did she put the pistol in my coat?
Oh, madame, had it never entered your head that Nick no longer liked you? Did you never feel that she might, in fact, hate you?
It's hard to say. We lived such an insincere life. She was fond of me, once.
Monsieur Lazarus, tell me frankly, was there anything between Mademoiselle Nick and you?
Nothing very serious. I was certainly attracted to her at one time, and then, I don't know why, I went off her.
Yes, that was her tragedy. She attracted people at first, and then, as you say, Mr. Lazarus, they went off her. And you fell in love with her closest friend. She began to hate Madame Rice. Madame who had your love and, as she believed, your wealth.
But in that case, why did she leave everything to me?
Ah, but that was last winter, when she was still fond of you, and when she had practically nothing to leave. But she remembered that will. She did not know that the Crofts had suppressed it, and she knew that with the death of Michael Seaton, it would appear to the world that you had a strong motive for doing away with her. That was why she made it seem that you had poisoned the chocolates. Tonight, the will would have been read, naming, as she believed, you as the inheritor of the Seaton millions, and then the pistol would have been found in your coat. The pistol with which Maggie had been shot.
She must have hated me.
Yes, madame. You had what she had not. The ability to win love and to keep it.
I may be very stupid, but I simply can't make head nor tail of this will business. How did the Crofts, or whatever their name really is, come into it?
Ah, that is a different operation entirely. The Crofts persuade madame to make a will and leave it with them to post, but they do not send it. They make another in its place. Then, if anything happens to Nick, the appendix operation goes wrong perhaps, they will produce the document that Millie Merton has so cleverly forged, in which everything is left to her. They had no idea that End House was so heavily mortgaged. They calculated on inheriting a valuable property.
But Nick sailed through the appendix operation without any trouble.
And so they wait. Then came the supposed attacks on Mademoiselle's life. Their hopes begin to rise again. When I announced that Nick was dead, they posted the forged will off to Mr. Bice. By then they knew all about the Seaton inheritance, and they thought that their plan had succeeded beyond their wildest dreams.
What I really want to know, Monsieur Poirot, is how did you first come to suspect Nick?
Oh, I am ashamed that it took me so long. It was when Maggie Buckley's parents sent me the letter that she had written to them on the day of her death. It contained one phrase that puzzled me.
You mean about why Nick had telegrammed her to come on Monday when she was arriving on Tuesday anyway?
Bravo, Hastings! That is exactly it. So Mademoiselle had lied to me. Or at least she had suppressed the truth. And if she could lie about that, some of the other things that she had told me might not be true also. But still it did not make sense. Why should she want Maggie Buckley killed? And then I suddenly recalled some trivial remarks that you were making a few minutes before, my friend, about abbreviations for Margaret. And it suddenly occurred to me to wonder, what was Maggie Buckley's real name?
You wondered whether it might have been Magdala.
It was an old family name. Mademoiselle had told me that. Now, what if Maggie were the Magdala Buckley to whom Michael Seaton had left everything? In my mind, I ran over the letters of his that Hastings and I had read. There was a mention of Scarborough.
Maggie was with Nick at Scarborough. That's where she met Seaton.
And it explained something that had worried me. Why were there so few letters? And why only those? And then it occurred to me. Nowhere in them was there any mention of a name.
But that's true. They all began darling or dearest love.
And there was something else, something I ought to have seen at once. Nowhere in any of those letters was there any mention of the appendix operation that Nick Buckley had undergone 6 months ago. No concern, no wishes for recovery. That should have told me that the letters were written to a different person altogether.
But what made you so convinced that Nick had hidden the pistol behind the secret panel?
Because Nick had so positively denied all knowledge of the panel's existence. She said that Ellen must be making it up. But why should Ellen do a thing like that? Again, I realized that Nick had been lying, which is why I persuaded my good friend Japp to hide behind the curtain and observe Nick take the pistol from its hiding place and put it in your pocket, madame.
All the same, I don't regret giving her my watch.
No, madame. And nor do I.
You know about that, too.
It's going to be a very unpleasant business. I must see about some form of defence for her, I suppose.
There will be no need of that, I think. That is where you concealed the stuff, is it not, Commander?
Huh?
In those wristwatches?
I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking
about.
Do
not try to deceive me with your bluff, hearty, good sailor manner. It may deceive Hastings, but it does not deceive me.
Huh?
You make a good thing out of the traffic in drugs, do you not? You are the useful boyfriend mentioned by Madame Rice in her letter to Nick. I advise you, if you do not want the facts put into the hands of the police, to leave at once.
Yes. You're right. I'd quite forgotten. I have an appointment to keep in Plymouth.
Did I not tell you, Hastings? Your instincts are always wrong.
You mean the cocaine was in the wristwatches?
Yes. That was why Mademoiselle had it with her so conveniently in the nursing home. And having put all her supply in the chocolates, she asked Madame Rice for her watch, which was full. But tonight she needed it for a different purpose. It will be a full dose this time.
Full dose?
It is the best way. Better than the hangman's rope. But we must not say so before Mr. Vice, who is all for law and order. The contents of the watch, it is the merest guess on my part.
Your guesses are always right, Monsieur Poirot.
I have heard nothing. I shall go before I make myself a fellow conspirator. Good night, Monsieur Poirot. All I can say is that it has been a most remarkable experience.
Good night, Monsieur Vice.
Good night, Mr. Vice.
And so, Madame Rice, Monsieur Lazarus, you intend to get married?
As soon as we can.
And I shan't need my wristwatch anymore.
I hope you will have great happiness, madame. You have suffered much, but despite everything, you still have the quality of mercy in your heart.
We must be going. It's late.
We have spent a strange night in an evil house. But of all my questions, there is one that is still unanswered. The picture of old Nick, Nick's grandfather, over the fireplace. She told me that you once offered £50 for it. It would give me great pleasure to know why you did that.
As you know, Monsieur Poirot, I am a dealer. That picture is worth not a penny more than £20. I knew that if I offered Nick 50, she would immediately suspect it was worth more and get it valued elsewhere. Then she would find that I had offered her more than it was worth. The next time I tried to buy a picture from her, she would not bother to get that one valued.
And so?
She did not know that the picture on the far wall is by Gainsborough.
As you say, monsieur, you are a dealer. Well, it is time for all of us to take our leave. I trust I shall never have to enter this house again, even though it has witnessed another of my little triumphs. And I shall think carefully before I announce again that I have solved my last case.
No more tempting the gods, Poirot?
Precisely, my friend. This is not the time to go back to the vegetable marrows. Who knows when the next bullet will come rolling towards my feet.
In Agatha Christie's Peril at End House, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat and Captain Hastings by Simon Williams. Chief Inspector Japp, Brian Pringle. Nick Buckley, Gemma Saunders. Frederica Rice, Susanna Hamilton. Mr. Croft, Terence Edmund. Mrs. Croft, Richenda Carey. Charles Weiss, Stephen Critchlow, Jimmy Lazarus, Sean Arnold, George Challenger, Andrew Wincott. Maggie Buckley, Elizabeth Conboy, Ellen the housekeeper, Hilda Schroeder, the doctor, Mark Holloway, the police inspector, David Thorpe. Peril at End House was dramatized by Michael Bakewell. It was directed by Enid Williams for BBC Radio 4.
To reconstruct the crime. That is the aim of the detective. To reconstruct a crime, you must place one fact upon another, just as you place one card upon another in building a house of cards. If the facts do not fit, if the cards will not balance, you must start your house again, or else it will fall.
We present John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and George Cole as Mr. Satterthwaite in Agatha Christie's three-act tragedy.
The strange story which I came to regard as a three-act tragedy began at Crow's Nest, a large bungalow perched high up on a cliff above Lulworth, where the celebrated actor Sir Charles Cartwright was giving a weekend party. Two of his guests had already arrived and were sitting on the terrace overlooking the sea.
Just look at him, stumping his way up the fisherman's path. Old grey flannel trousers, white sweater, peaked cap. The very model of a retired naval man.
He's even got the rolling nautical gait. Yes, perfect, quite perfect.
I would never have believed that he'd have stayed down here for so long. In exile, so to speak.
Well, no more would I, but he's always been a better actor in private life than on the stage. Well, I've known him since he was a boy. We went up to Oxford together. He's never stopped acting. Not for a moment.
Second nature, I suppose, Sir Bartholomew.
Yes, Charles doesn't go out of a room. He makes an exit. And he usually gives himself a good line to make it on. All the same, he likes a change of part.
Yes, but to bury himself down here for 2 years.
To lead a simple life close to the sea. Mm. That's what he said he wanted. Well, I was like you, Satterthwaite. I didn't think he'd stick it for a week. After all, Charles is only human. He needs his audience. Two or three retired captains, a bunch of old women and a parson. That's not much of a house to play to. That's what it seems when we're wrong. Obviously, the attraction of a simple life still holds.
You don't think that perhaps there is something else that holds him down here?
Somebody else, more like it. Oh, but here he comes. The last thing we want is for him to think we've been talking about him.
You two landlubbers shouldn't be wasting a glorious morning like this sitting on your backsides. You should have been out on the sea with me. Mirabelle really surpassed herself.
I was watching you from my bedroom window when you set out, and I heartily thanked heaven that I was on dry land.
Well, you ought to have come, Tolly. Hmm? Don't you spend half your life in Harley Street telling your patients how much fitter they'd feel if they were out on the ocean wave?
The great merit of being a doctor is that you're not obliged to follow your own advice. Did you go out by yourself?
No, I had a hand. Egg, to be exact.
Egg? Hermione Lytton Gore, usually known for some obscure reason as Egg. She knows quite a bit about sailing, I fancy.
She succeeds in making me feel a complete beginner. But I'm coming on.
Thanks to Egg.
Yes. Thanks to her.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Ah, good morning, Miss Gore.
Good morning. It's rare.
This is the menu for dinner. Are there any alterations you would wish to make?
Let's have a look at it. Melon cantaloupe, borch, fresh mackerel, grouse, souffle surprise. Coupe d'Anne. Yeah, I think that will do excellently, Miss Murray. Everyone is coming by the 4 o'clock train.
I have already given Holgate his orders. By the way, Sir Charles, if you will excuse me, it would be better if I dined with you tonight.
Oh, we would all be delighted, Miss Murray, but...
Otherwise, Sir Charles, it would make 13 at table. And so many people are superstitious.
Well, thank you, Miss Murray. How very far-sighted. It would never have occurred to me.
Thank you, Sir Charles.
That is a very remarkable woman. I'm always afraid she'll come and brush my teeth for me.
She's certainly a model of efficiency.
Who's coming down this afternoon?
Well, Angie, for one.
Well, Angela Sutcliffe. Yeah. But surely she's in much ado.
I finished last week.
I thought she was running a risk, taking on Beatrice at her age.
Nonsense. Ellen Terry was 59 when she played it at a Jubilee.
And are the Dacres coming?
Well, I trust so. If she can tear herself away from a fashion house... And if he can give up the horses for once in a while. And then there's Anthony Astor.
The woman who wrote One-Way Traffic.
Uh-huh.
I saw it twice. It was a great hit.
And what is his or her real name?
Oh, I can never remember. Mills, something like that.
Wills, I think.
I've only met her once. The only reason she's coming is that Angela was curious about her.
And the locals?
Well, there are the Babingtons. He's the parson. Quite a good fellow. Not too personified. And his wife's a really nice woman, lectures me on gardening. And then there's Lady Mary and Egg, of course, and a young fellow called Manders. He's a journalist or something like that.
But with ourselves, that only makes 12. Either you or Miss Milray must have counted wrong.
It couldn't be Miss Milray. That woman's never wrong. And you're right. I have missed one guest. Hercule Poirot.
Oh.
Slipped my mind completely. And he wouldn't care for that. He's a very high opinion of himself. Do you know him, Sandersmith?
Yes, I am acquainted with him.
Ah.
Rather a remarkable character.
I've heard about him, of course. I hope we don't have a murder this weekend.
Because we've got Poirot in the house. Isn't that rather putting the cart before the horse, eh?
No, it's my way of being a theory of mine.
And what exactly is that theory?
That events come to people. Not people to events.
How do you mean?
Well, why do some people have exciting lives and other people dull ones?
Well,
because of their surroundings? No, not at all. Not at all. One man may travel to the ends of the earth and nothing will happen to him. There'll be a massacre a week before he arrives, an earthquake the day after he leaves, and the boat that he missed will be shipwrecked. Another man may live at Balham and travel to the city every day, and the most extraordinary things will happen to him. Have been mixed up with blackmailing gangs and beautiful girls and motor bandits. There are people with a tendency to shipwrecks. Even if they take out a boat to an ornamental lake, something will happen to it. In the same way, characters like your Hercule Poirot don't have to go out of their way to look for crime. It comes to them.
Well, in that case, perhaps it's just as well that Miss Milray is joining us for dinner and that we're not going to sit down at a table for 13.
Well, you can have your murder, Tolly, if you're so keen on it. I make only one stipulation, that I shan't be the corpse.
I had no idea why I had been invited to the weekend party at Crow's Nest. I hardly knew Sir Charles. I had seen him in the theatre, of course, but he was scarcely a close acquaintance. But I accepted the invitation out of curiosity, and because, I must confess, I was feeling a little bored. But I felt ill at ease with the company. they all appear to know one another so well.
Yes.
And I settled down in a quiet corner with the only person I could claim as an acquaintance. Mr. Satterthwaite, an amateur detective of some talent and a shrewd observer of things and people.
It really is quite impossible to tell what Mrs. Dacres actually looks like. The greenish bronze hair, that perfect tan. And surely her lips can't possibly really be that shape.
My dear, it wasn't possible. I mean, things either are possible or they are not. This wasn't. It was simply penetrating.
Penetrating. That is the word of the moment. Everything is penetrating. And the man who looks like the rather scruffy fox. That is the lady's husband, I take it.
Captain Dacres, yes.
Oh, no. I went to Cap Ferrar. Everyone said I should go there.
And who is the lady with the receding chin, dressed in excessively limp green chiffon?
But I didn't enjoy it at all. Not what you might call a friendly place.
That is Miss Wills, the playwright Anthony Astor.
But, of course, it's terribly useful to me in my work to see all the goings-on, you know.
Alas, she is not at all like her plays. Anthony Astor gives the impression of being a man of the world.
Whereas she looks as though she'd be more at home in a boarding house in Boscombe.
Mary, at last!
Oh, dear. I do hope we're not late.
No.
That is Lady Mary Lytton Gore. Such a very charming person. Rather fallen upon hard times.
You're looking very dapper tonight, Charles.
Oh.
And that is her daughter, Hermione, known as Egg.
Egg? How very curious. And who is that exceedingly sleek young man to whom she is talking?
Sailing? I gave that up ages ago.
Oliver Manders. A rather aggressive young man, I believe.
He's also damn childish, all that messing about in boats. I would have thought you would have grown out of it by now.
Oh, good evening, Sir Charles. What a great pleasure.
Oh, Lord, here's Babington. Keep talking to me, I can't stand him. Country parsons ought to be put down.
Cocktails at last. I'm simply dying for a drink.
Cocktail, madam? Well, I think I just might. Thank you. Do you care for a cocktail, sir?
Thank you.
And you, sir?
Thank you. I do not care for the cocktail, but I can hardly demand a syrup.
Here you are, Egg.
Thank you, Charles. You can have one, Mums. Just one.
Thank you, dear.
I'll get you a sherry, Tolly. I know you can't bear cocktails.
How very considerate, Charles.
Do you care for a cocktail, Mr. Babington?
Thank you. I think my wife would allow me to have one. I trust the effects will have worn off by the time I have to deliver my sermon tomorrow. A little stronger than I expected.
Mr. Babington, are you all right?
Help me get him over to the sofa.
I suppose the poor old chap's never had a cocktail before.
No, it cannot be that. Some kind of seizure, perhaps.
Well, what's happened? What's the matter with Babington?
I'm sorry to have to tell you. He's dead.
For a while, all was confusion. But Miss Milroy showed her customary efficiency on the telephone.
Dr. McDougall, I think you'd better come up to Crow's Nest immediately. One of Sir Charles's guests appears to have been taken seriously ill.
Lady Mary had led the weeping Mrs. Babington out of the room and had finally gone home with her to the vicarage.
I think that under the circumstances, Sir Charles, it might be better if we were to serve a simplified form of dinner.
Of course, Miss Milroy, whatever you think best.
Oliver Manders drove Egg back home to her mother's house, and by mutual consent the rest of the house party retired to their rooms when dinner was over.
Charles doesn't like it. Poor old Babington's death, I mean.
It was very distressing. Very distressing indeed.
I have an idea. He thinks it was rather more than that. He wants us to join him for a conference in the ship room.
Ever see anyone die quite like that before, Tolly?
No, I can't say I have. But I haven't really seen as many deaths as you might suppose. A nerve specialist doesn't kill off great quantities of his patients. He keeps them alive and makes his money out of them.
What does Dr. McDougall think?
Well, he said it was some kind of seizure. The Babington was elderly and his health none too good. But he didn't see the man die. It doesn't satisfy me.
Probably didn't satisfy him, but a doctor has to say something. After all, Babington was elderly and not in the best of health.
Was it a typical fit? Raw seizure, or whatever you call it?
Well, if you'd ever studied medicine, you'd know there is hardly such a thing as a typical case.
What precisely are you suggesting, Charles?
Now, Charles doesn't know himself. His mind's turning to the dramatic possibilities.
Damn it all, Tolly, this man dropped dead in my house.
Yeah, so what are you suggesting? Some untraceable poison in the cocktails?
No, hardly that. After all, I mix them.
Well, perhaps you had a sudden fit of homicidal mania. I suppose the symptoms are delayed in our case and we'll all be dead in the morning.
Why do you have to make a joke of it all, Tolly?
I'm not really joking. I just don't want you, quite thoughtlessly, to do harm.
Harm?
Don't you see the danger these vague suspicions of yours might cause? A suggestion of foul play, totally unfounded, might cause serious trouble and pain to Mrs. Babington. Rumours flying about all over the place that no one can stop.
I must admit, I hadn't thought of it like that, Tolly. But it wasn't just my dramatic instinct taking over. I really do have a hunch that something is wrong.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Nothing has been touched in here since Mr. Babington's death. The cocktail glasses are exactly where they were.
This one here
is Mr. Babington's. I saw him put it down on the table just before he collapsed. I suggest that Sir Bartholomew should get the contents analysed. That can be done quietly and without causing any talk.
Oh, very well. Will that satisfy you, Charles?
Well, of course. But you know, Tolly, you are partly responsible for my flight of fancy.
What do you mean by that?
Because of what you said this morning about Hercule Poirot. That he was a kind of stormy petrel, and where he went, sudden death followed. No sooner does he arrive than somebody drops dead on the carpet. Are you surprised if my thoughts fly immediately off to murder?
I wonder whether we could...
Yes, I had thought of that. Could we ask him what he thinks of it all?
You mean, is it etiquette?
No, I do know that you can't ask a professional singer to sing. Can one ask a professional detective to detect?
Come in.
I hope I am not intruding, Sir Charles.
Not at all. Do come in. Take a seat. We were just talking about you. May I offer you a drink?
Oh, thank you, but no, I do not touch the whiskey.
Very well. I'm not going to beat about the bush. We've been talking about what happened this evening. Do you think there's anything wrong about it?
Wrong? What exactly do you mean by that?
Our friends got it into his head that Mr. Babington was murdered.
And you do not think so?
We'd like to know what you think.
And she was, of course, taken ill very suddenly.
We have the glass from which Mr. Babington drank, and there's still some liquid remaining in it. Should we at least get it analysed?
Well, that at any rate can do no harm. As a judge of human nature, it seems to me unlikely in the extreme that anyone would wish to do away with a charming old clergyman. However, the cocktail glass will tell us one way or another.
And the result of the analysis will be what?
You are asking me to guess the result of the analysis?
Yes.
Oh, then I can only predict they will find nothing but the remains of an excellent dry martini. To poison a man with a cocktail, one of many handed round on a tray, would be very difficult. How could one be certain he would take the right glass?
True.
And that, since you ask me, gentlemen, is my opinion. It seems to me most unlikely that anyone could be murdered under those circumstances. But let us await the results of the analysis.
So what did you make of the inquest, Mrs. Satterthwaite?
Well, I suppose it was rather what I anticipated.
But did you really go along with what Dr. McDougall said?
Well, I...
Didn't you think that behind all that frightful technical stuff he was just hedging? What he said was there was nothing to show that death hadn't arisen from natural causes. He didn't say that it was the result of natural causes.
Oh, aren't you rather splitting hairs, my dear? After all, nothing was found in Mr. Babington's glass but a gin and vermouth.
But the only thing wrong with Mr. Babington was that he had a touch of rheumatoid arthritis. That doesn't make you fall down in a fit. He was the sort of creaking gait that would have lived to be 90.
But, my dear, who on earth would want to murder him?
That's what Oliver keeps on saying.
Oliver Manders. Isn't he rather a particular friend of yours?
He used to be. Now we scrap all the time. He's gone into his uncle's office in the city and he's getting... well, a bit oily, if you know what I mean. He's obsessed with getting rich. I think everybody is rather disgusting about money, don't you, Mr. Satterthwaite?
My dear, so many people are disgusting about so many things.
Poor Mr. Babington. He really was rather a pet. He prepared me for confirmation and all that. It's all bunkum, of course, but he really was very sweet about it. That's why I feel I can't go along with all that natural causes stuff. What if someone jammed him with a hypodermic?
Containing the untraceable poison of a lost tribe of Amazonian Indians?
You may laugh, but someday perhaps you'll find we're right.
We?
Sir Charles and I. Why hasn't he ever married?
Sir Charles? Well, I have no idea.
That girl who died of consumption. Or some actress or other. Her name began with M. Wasn't he supposed to be in love with her?
Well, I hardly think...
I suppose he's had lots of affairs.
Yes, probably.
I like men to have affairs. It shows they're not queer or anything. You know, Sir Charles is really much cleverer than you think. He dramatizes himself a bit, but behind all that, he's got brains. He's far better at sailing a boat than you'd ever believe to hear him talk. I know you think the only reason he's so interested in Mr. Babington's death is because he wants to play the part of the great detective. All I can say is, I think he'd do it rather well.
Possibly.
But your view is that death of a clergyman isn't a thriller, merely a social catastrophe. What did Monsieur Poirot think? He ought to know.
Well, he didn't seem to think there was anything at all suspicious about Babington's death.
Oh. Well, he's getting old. He's just a back number. Come home and have tea with Mother. She likes you, she said so.
Well, I really should be getting back to Sir Charles.
Oh, don't worry about that. I'll ring him up and explain. And you can have a good chat with Mother.
I like Sir Charles very much. Success hasn't spoiled him. In many ways, he's a child still, and such charm. I feel it as well as egg. I suppose you've noticed she's suffering badly from hero worship.
Well, I could hardly...
But she's seen so little of the world. We're so badly off. One of my cousins presented her and took her to a few things in town, but most of the time she's been stuck down here. Sir Charles coming to Lumeth has done a lot for her. There are so few young people here, especially men. I've always been afraid that Egg might marry someone simply because he was the only person around.
Are you by any chance thinking of Oliver Manders?
How very perceptive of you, Mr. Satterthwaite. He and Egg were always together at one time. I know I'm old-fashioned, but I really do not care for some of his advanced ideas.
Youth must have its fling.
It would be quite a suitable match, of course. Manders' uncle has recently taken him into the firm, and he's a very rich man. Still, I suppose it's very silly of me, but...
All the same, Lady Mary, you wouldn't like Egg to marry a man twice her age.
It might be safer, you know. At that age, a man's follies and sins is definitely behind him.
I'm sorry I've been such ages, but I've been talking to Sir Charles. He's all alone up there. You didn't tell me the house party had flitted.
Oh, yes. Most of them went back yesterday. All but Sir Bartholomew Strange. Oh. He had intended to stay on until tomorrow, but he had an urgent telegram from London this morning. Oh. One of his patients has taken a turn for the worse.
It's rather a nuisance they're all going off like that. I wanted to take a closer look at them all. One of them might have given me a clue.
A clue to what, darling?
I've arranged to go up there after dinner and take Oliver with me. We can talk the whole mystery through. If we all put our heads together, you never know what we might come up with.
But the discussion, it seems, was not a great success. Oliver Manders was lazily sceptical.
Can't you talk Egg out of this nonsense, Sir Charles?
Huh?
It's this appallingly healthy country life she leads that makes her so energetic.
Uh-huh. What on earth do you mean by that?
You're becoming so detestably hearty. And you really are being quite remarkably childish over this murder business. It's rubbish. Utter rubbish.
Do you really believe that, Manders?
Well, no question of it. That dear, bleating old clergyman. He wasn't worth murdering. It's fantastic to think of anything but natural causes.
Care for a nightcap, Satterthwaite?
No, I don't think so, thanks.
Don't mind if I have one, I trust.
No.
God they've gone. I couldn't bear to be in the same room any longer. I'm leaving here tomorrow, for good.
What on earth are you talking about?
It's the only thing to do. I shall put this place on the market. What it has meant to me, no one will ever know.
But why?
Did you see them as they went down the path in the moonlight? Egg turned her face to that Manders fellow and he kissed her. They're made for each other, those two. Cut your losses. It's the only way. I shall clear out.
Where to?
What does it matter? In the heat of the desert or the heart of the crowd, I've always been a solitary soul. I should probably go to Monte Carlo. But don't cut your visit here short, my dear fellow. Stay on another day or two, and I'll tell Miss Milray to arrange for a car to take you over to your friends at Tavistock. But as for me, I shall leave first thing in the morning. I mustn't look back. That would be fatal. Never look back.
Sir Charles was as good as his word. He departed the following morning by the first train, leaving the capable Miss Milray to telephone estate agents and to dispatch cables abroad. He told no one. He was playing a role he had acted many times in the theatre, that of the strong, silent man who renounces the girl he loves for her own good.
But where's he gone?
Abroad, to the south of France, I think.
Which of those damn bitches is it?
What did you say?
One of those two women who were up there the other night must have seen the way Charles and I were looking at one another and decided to get him away from me. Was it the one with the green hair and all those wonderful clothes? Or the grey-haired one he called Angie? The one with lots of S.A.
S.A.?
Sex appeal.
Ah.
Which of them was it?
My dear, you're quite mistaken. He isn't in the least interested in either of them.
Then why has he gone away without telling me?
Well, I rather think he thought it best.
Do you mean it's because of me?
Well, something of the sort, perhaps.
Oh, I suppose I did show my hand a bit too plainly. Men do so hate being chased, don't they?
I rather think it was more to do with Oliver Manders.
You mean that Charles saw me do my kissing act last night?
Well, as a matter of fact, he did.
But that was only because I thought he needed a bit of encouraging. I thought perhaps if he saw me and Oliver, well, it might wake him up a bit.
Well, wasn't that a little unfair on Oliver?
Not in the least. He thinks it's an honour for any girl to be kissed by him. I expect I've made him feel more conceited than ever, but one can't think of everything. I simply wanted to ginger Charles up a bit. He's been so standoffish lately.
Well, I'm afraid it did not have quite the effect you intended. Sir Charles got the impression that you were passionately in love with Oliver Manders. He went away to spare himself further pain.
Is that really true? Oh, the idiot. The sainted idiot. But if that is really why he went away, he'll come back. And if he doesn't...
If he doesn't?
I'll get him back somehow. You see if I don't.
And so, as Sir Charles sped southwards across France on the Train Bleu, the first act of our tragedy came to an end. But fool that I was, I did not see it as a tragedy at all. Merely the sudden death from natural causes of a lovable old clergyman. Events were to prove me disastrously wrong. The second act of our tragedy began peacefully enough. I had taken myself for a few days to the French Riviera and was sitting in the public gardens at Monte Carlo, doing nothing in particular, watching a bored little child tugging at his mother's sleeve.
Mummy, isn't there anything to do?
Darling, isn't it enough to have come abroad and be in the beautiful sunshine?
No, it isn't. nothing to do.
Monsieur Poirot, what a very pleasant surprise to find you in Monte Carlo.
Mr. Satterthwaite, oh, I am delighted to see you. Please, sit down, I beg you.
Oh, thank you. You know, everyone seems to be here. Not half an hour ago, I ran across Sir Charles Cartwright.
Sir Charles? What a curious coincidence. It was at his house in Devon that we last met, was it not?
He's given it up now.
Huh? Given it up? How very surprising.
I don't know whether it's all that surprising. Sir Charles is not really the kind of man who likes to live permanently away from the world.
Yes, that is very true, but I am surprised for another reason. It seemed to me that Sir Charles had a different motive for staying at Lumouth. A very charming motive, am I not right?
Mm.
The little demoiselle who calls herself so amusingly the egg.
Hermione Lytton-Gore. Mm. So you noticed that, did you?
It leaped to the eye. And I have the heart very susceptible to lovers. You too, I think. And La Jeunesse, it is always touching.
She is the reason why Sir Charles left Lumouth. He was running away.
But from Mademoiselle Egg? But it was obvious that he adored her. Why should he run?
I'm afraid you don't quite understand our Anglo-Saxon complexes.
Of course, it is a very good tactic. Run from a woman and immediately she follows. Doubtless a man of much experience like Sir Charles knows that.
I don't think it was actually quite like that. But what are you doing here, Monsieur Poirot? Taking a holiday?
Oh, my time is all holidays now. I have achieved all that I wish to do. And now I retire. Je m'amuse.
Mummy, play with me. I'm bored.
You see, Mr. Satterthwaite, when I was a boy, I was poor. We were a large family and I had to get on in the world. I entered the police force. I worked hard. I began to make a name for myself. I acquired an international reputation. At last, I was due to retire. Then came the war. I was injured. I came a sad and weary refugee to England. A kind lady gave me hospitality. She died. Not naturally, no, she was killed. And so I set my wits to work. I employed the little Graysells. I discovered the murderer.
Ah, you're speaking of the mysterious affair at Stiles Court.
Oh, 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 I am flattered that you remember the case, Mr. Satterthwaite. It was that experience that made me realize I was not yet finished. My powers were, in fact, stronger than ever. Then began my second career, that of a private inquiry agent in your country. I have solved many fascinating and baffling problems. The psychology of human nature, it is wonderful. I began to grow rich. Someday, I said to myself, I will have all the money I need. I will realize all my dreams.
Mommy, why won't you play with me?
My friend, beware of the day when your dreams come true. That child over there, doubtless he too has dreamed of coming abroad, of how different everything would be. You understand?
I understand you are not amusing yourself.
Exactly.
Have you seen this, Monsieur Poirot, in the morning paper? This paragraph here.
It is with great regret that we announce the death of Sir Bartholomew Strange. Ah, this is the rather distinguished gentleman who was at Sir Charles's house party, the one he called Tolly.
Yes, but read on, Monsieur Poirot.
Sir Bartholomew was entertaining a party of friends at Melfort Abbey, his house in Yorkshire. He appeared to be in perfect health and spirits, and his demise occurred quite suddenly at the end of dinner. He was chatting with his friends and drinking a glass of port when he had a sudden seizure and died almost instantaneously. It is very similar to the way in which that old clergyman died. A quite remarkable coincidence.
I think it's more than that, Monsieur Poirot. And Sir Charles is certain that there is a connection between the two deaths. He has gone to the offices of the Vargon Lee Company to book tickets for him and myself on the night train to London.
Oh, what zeal he has, Sir Charles, so determined to play the role of the amateur detective. Or is there another reason?
Well, as it happens, he had just received a letter from Miss Lytton-Gore. I was with him when it was delivered.
It's an appeal for help. She's begging me to return.
Is this the first letter you've had from her?
No, I have one just after I got here, just giving me the local news and all that. I didn't answer it, of course. Didn't dare to. The girl had no idea why I'd gone away, and I didn't want to make a fool of myself.
And are you going to reply to this one?
Damn it, man, this is different. She was there at Melford Abbey when it happened, when poor Tolly suddenly keeled over. Here, read it for yourself. The poor kid's obviously in a bit of a state.
You'll have seen by now, I expect, that Sir Bartholomew Strange is dead. Well, he died just the same way as Mr. Babington. It can't be coincidence. I'm worried to death. Couldn't you come home and do something? You see, I'm very concerned about someone. He had absolutely nothing to do with it, but things might look a bit odd. I can't explain it in a letter, but won't you come back? After all, it's your own friend who's been killed, and if you don't take a hand in it, perhaps no one will ever find out the truth. And I'm sure you could. I know it in my bones.
Who do you think she means by someone?
Manders, I suppose.
Was he there, then?
Well, he must have been. I can't imagine why. Tolly never met him except on that one occasion at my house. Why he should ask him to stay, I cannot imagine.
Well, we can easily settle that. There must have been some mention of the party in the society columns of one of the papers before all this happened.
Well, there's a stack of them over there.
Did Sir Bartholomew often give these house parties?
Three or four times a year. This one would have been for the St. Ledger.
Did he spend much of his time in Yorkshire?
He had a big sanatorium, nursing home, whatever you like to call it. He bought Melford Abbey, restored it, and built a sanatorium in the grounds.
I found it. Good Lord.
What's the matter?
Nearly all the people at the house party were the same ones that were at yours.
Who?
Lady Lytton Gore and Egg, Captain and Mrs. Dacres, Angela Sutcliffe, Muriel Wills.
But no mention of Mr. Manders.
No. But you must admit the guest list stretches coincidence a bit far.
Yes, it is curious. And you are going back with Sir Charles?
Well, this sort of thing is rather in my line, Miss Hillborough.
Ah, yes. Your experiences with the mysterious Mr. Quinn.
Mm. And I do happen to know the Chief Constable in that part of the world quite well.
Tell me, Mr. Satterthwaite, why did you not mention the matter of Sir Bartholomew's death as soon as you sat down here?
Oh, it didn't seem quite the moment at first. And then I had no wish to disturb your fascinating reminiscences. You yourself are not tempted to come back and take an interest in the case?
Oh, I think not. I am too old to rush backwards and forwards. And the Mediterranean, it is such a beautiful blue.
Then I will leave you to enjoy it. But should you wish to call on me in London, here is my card to remind you of my address.
I remained where I was for a quarter of an hour or so. But it seemed that the Mediterranean was no longer as blue as it had been.
I've done that, Mummy. What shall I do next?
It was a good question. I thought that perhaps it was time for me to take a walk to the Wagon Lee offices. But I was going to take my time. I had no wish to interfere in the investigation of the admirable Sir Charles and the meticulous Mr. Satterthwaite.
Delighted to meet you, Sir Charles. My wife is a very keen playgoer. She's one of your greatest fans, as the Americans say.
Well, I'm very honoured, Colonel.
I gather that Sir Bartholomew Strange was by way of being a friend of yours.
A very old friend.
He was very popular around here, of course. Last man in the world, you'd expect to be murdered, but murder is what it looks like.
Sir Charles and I have only just come back from abroad. We've only seen snippets here and there in the papers.
Well, let me tell you exactly how the matter stands. There's little doubt that the butler's the man we're after, a chap by the name of Ellis. He was a new man. Strange had only had him a fortnight. And the moment after the murder, he disappears, vanishes into thin air. Looks a bit fishy, huh?
You've no notion where he went.
Negligence on our part, you think? Well, I admit it damn well looks like it. The fella answered all our questions quite satisfactorily. Gave the name of the London agency which obtained him the place. All very civil spoken, no signs of panic. Next thing, he'd gone, and the house was still under observation.
Quite extraordinary.
Now, apart from anything else, it seems a damn fool thing to do. I mean, why do a bolt and draw attention to himself if he wasn't suspected?
No, lost his nerve, got the wind up.
Have you verified the account he gave of himself?
Naturally. London agency confirms his story. He had a reference from Sir Horace Bird recommending him warmly. Trouble is, Sir Horace is in South Africa at the moment.
So the reference could have been forged, huh?
Exactly. We've wired Sir Horace, but it may be some time before we get a reply. Apparently he's on safari.
When exactly did the butler disappear?
Sometime during the night after the murder. He went to his room after we talked to him, and the following morning he was missing. His bed hadn't been slept in. One of the ladies staying at the Abbey, Miss Sutcliffe, the actress, well, you know her, I expect, Sir Charles.
Oh, very well indeed, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, she suggested that the man had left the house by way of a secret passage. Sounds a bit Edgar Wallace, but it seems there really was such a thing. Strange was rather proud of it.
I understand that Sir Bartholomew died of nicotine poisoning.
That's right. Most unusual stuff to use. Though I understand that if a man's a heavy smoker, such as Strange was, it would tend to complicate matters. I mean, he might have died of nicotine poisoning in a natural way. Only, of course, this business was too sudden for that.
How was it administered?
We don't know that yet. According to the medical evidence, it could only have been swallowed a few minutes previous to death.
I understand they were drinking port.
Mm-hmm. And you'd expect the stuff to be in the port, but it wasn't. That glass contained nothing but port.
You see, Satterthwaite, it's the same. Exactly the same as before.
Now, you're talking about the old clergyman who dropped dead at your house, Sir Charles.
How the devil did you get to hear of that?
Well, from a very charming young lady, Miss Lytton Gore. She's gone back to Devon now. She was adamant there was some kind of link between the two cases. But I don't believe there's anything in it. It doesn't explain the flight of the butler, and you can depend on it, he is our man. Very likely he'll turn out to be a regular criminal. Unfortunately, we haven't got any fingerprints. We had an expert go over his bedroom and the butler's pantry, but had no luck.
But if it was the butler, what motive could he have had?
That, of course, is one of our difficulties. Strange might have caught him stealing or something of the sort.
Was anything actually missing from the house? Silver, jewellery, anything like that?
Nothing. At least not as far as we know.
Who actually was staying in the house?
We'll get Superintendent Crossfield in. He's the chap to give you all the details. Very reliable and most methodical.
It's a very odd case indeed. I've never come across nicotine poisoning before.
I thought it was the kind of disease you got from smoking too much.
To tell the truth, sir, so did I. But the doctor says it's an odourless liquid, pure alkaloid, and that a few drops of it are enough to kill a man almost instantly.
Pretty potent stuff.
And yet it's in pretty common use. They use nicotine solution for spraying roses.
Roses? Now, why should that ring a bell?
Anything fresh to report, Gosfield?
Oh, nothing definite, sir. We've had sightings of Ellis all over England. Durham, Ipswich, Balham. Mind you, the moment a man's description is circulated, people see him everywhere.
What exactly is the man's description?
John Ellis. Medium height, stoops slightly, grey hair, small side whiskers, dark eyes, husky voice, tooth missing in upper jaw, noticeable when he smiles.
Very nondescript, bar the side whiskers and the tooth. And the first will be off by now, and he'll be taking care not to smile.
Can you tell us who exactly was in Strange's party on the night of the crime, Crossfield?
Lord and Lady Eden, Sir Jocelyn and Lady Campbell, Miss Angela Sutcliffe, Captain and Mrs. Dacres, Lady Mary and Miss Hermione Lytton Gore, Miss Muriel Wills, Mr. Oliver Manders.
The reports didn't mention Miss Wills, but I suppose they wouldn't. And young Manders was there, after all.
He wasn't one of the invited guests, I gather. No. The young gentleman ran his motorbike into the wall not far from the Abbey gates. Sir Bartholomew, who was, I understand, slightly acquainted with him, asked him to stay the night.
Rather a careless thing for the boy to do.
I fancy the young gentleman must have had one over the eight. Uh-huh. I can't imagine how he could have managed to hit the wall the way he did if he was sober.
Well, thank you very much, Superintendent. Yeah, any objection to our going over to have a look round the Abbey, Colonel?
Of course not, Sir Charles. Though I doubt whether you'll find out anything I haven't already told you.
Poor old Tolly certainly made a good job of patching up the old abbey. Magnificent, don't you think?
Oh, it must have cost him a pretty penny. So, what do you think? Was it the butler?
Of course it wasn't the butler. He's a red herring. He couldn't have had anything to do with old Babington's death.
You're still convinced the two deaths are connected?
They must be. Why were all the people who were at my place present at the second murder? It was a plan. Tolly's plan.
You mean he invited them all up here deliberately?
I'm certain of it. But we'd better be getting along to the house. You didn't know Tolly as well as I did. He kept his own counsel and was a very, very patient man.
But he thought the whole idea that Babington had been murdered was ridiculous.
Well, he may have said so, but I reckon he had suspicions of his own. He didn't talk about them, that wasn't his way. But quietly, in his own mind, he was building up a case. He knew that one of my guests was responsible for the crime, and he gathered them all up here for some kind of test.
But what about the people who weren't at your party? The Edens and the Campbells?
Camouflage, Satterthwaite, to make the whole thing less obvious.
Well, what do you think his plan was?
Well, how can we know? I'm not a magician. But there was a plan, and it went wrong, because the murderer was one degree cleverer than Tolly reckoned, and he struck first.
He?
Or she. Poison is as much a woman's weapon as it is a man's, more so.
But there were certain people who weren't invited.
Well, I was in France, so were you. And he could hardly have invited poor old Babington's widow.
And I suppose young Manders is out of it, too. He only arrived by accident.
If that's what it was. And I can't really believe that the Lytton Gores had anything to do with Babington's death.
What about Angela Sutcliffe?
Angela? She's been a friend of Tolly's for years.
So that leaves us with the Dacres.
Well, I suppose they're more possible than anyone else. But for the life of me, I can't see why Freddie Dacres, who spends his life on the race course, or Cynthia, who makes a packet designing fabulously expensive clothes for women with more money than sense, should have any desire to remove a dear, insignificant old clergyman.
We've forgotten someone else.
Huh?
That writer woman who calls herself Anthony Astor.
Miss Muriel Wills of Tooting. What is there about her that continually makes one forget her? She's the most damnably nondescript woman I've ever met.
I fancy she might embody that line of Robert Burns, a chiel's among ye, taking notes. I imagine Miss Wills spends much of her time taking notes. There are sharp eyes behind those unflattering glasses of hers. I think you'll find that anything worth noticing in this affair has already been noticed by Miss Wills.
Really? Well, while we're here, we'd better have a word with the housekeeper. What did Crossfield say her name was?
Lecky. Mrs. Lecky.
Oh, that I should ever have lived to see such a thing. Such a proud day it was for all of us when the doctor was made Sir Bartholomew. And the questions the policeman asked about all the maids in the house. Good girls they are, every one of them. And no police superintendent shall make me say otherwise. When asked to having anything to do with murder...
This man Ellis, did you find anything unusual about him?
Well, I did and I didn't. See, for one thing, he was standoffish. He kept himself to himself. Spent a lot of time in his own room and he was... Well, there was something.
You did not suspect that he was not really a butler?
Oh, no, sir, he'd been in service all right. The things he knew. And about the best people in society, too. But he wasn't like any butler I've ever worked with before. He arranged the work differently.
And what did Sir Bartholomew think of him?
Oh, he was pleased enough. He even had a bit of a joke with him.
Well, what did he say?
Well, Mr. Ellis come up with a telephone message, and Sir Bartholomew asked him if he'd got the name right. And Mr. Ellis said, quite sure. Oh, speaking respectful, of course.
Go on, Mrs. Lecky.
Well, Sir Bartholomew laughed and said, you're a good fellow, Ellis. A first-class butler. Don't you agree, Mrs. Lecky? And I was so surprised, sir, at the master speaking like that, that, well, I didn't know what to think.
What was the telephone message? Can you remember?
It was from the sanatorium, about a patient who had just arrived there and who'd stood the journey well.
Do you remember the name?
Yeah. It was a queer name, sir. A Mrs. de Rushbridger. Well, Something like that.
Yes, not an easy name to get right on the telephone.
And what about the guests? Did you notice anything unusual about their behaviour?
Oh, well, sir, that Miss Wills, she wasn't quite the class of the others. Well, she did things a real lady wouldn't have done. Poked and pried about. That's not a nice thing to do, not after somebody's dead. And poor Miss Sutcliffe, she quite broke down. Very warm-hearted lady.
And Mrs. Dacres?
I don't think anything would upset her much. She was just anxious to get away. Said her business would suffer.
What about her husband?
Steadied his nerves with brandy. Or unsteadied them, some would say.
And do you have any views on who might have poisoned your master, Mrs. Leckie?
Well, I suppose it must have been Mr. Ellis, seeing the way he just vanished overnight. But I don't see how he could have done it. They're saying it was something in the port. But all the gentlemen had port, and some of the ladies. And in any case, they couldn't find anything in the glass.
Thank you, Mrs. Leckie. You've been very helpful. Now, would you mind if we took a look at Mr. Ellis's room?
Oh, no, sir, I've no objection. Of course, the police have been all over it, but they couldn't find a thing.
So what do you think, Satterthwaite?
Well, the only thing...
Yeah? Go on, man.
It struck me as a little odd the way Sir Bartholomew joked with his butler. It seemed somehow so uncharacteristic.
It was uncharacteristic. I knew Tolly well, better than you did, and I can tell you he wasn't a facetious sort of man. But where does it get us? What is curious is that it occurred immediately after that telephone message.
About the patient who had arrived at the sanatorium?
Yes. And I think it's a fair deduction to assume it was that telephone message which was the cause of Tolly's sudden hilarity. I can't imagine what it could have been, but I'm certain there must be some significance in that message. Something tells me that this Mrs. de Rushbridger may have something to do with the mystery.
Well, I can't say I think it's very likely, but this must be Ellis's room. We'll find something here that the police passed over.
Of course, they were looking for evidence of Ellis's guilt. We're looking for evidence of his innocence, a very different matter.
There doesn't seem to be much in the way of evidence of any kind. Boots neatly polished, a couple of extremely well-cut suits.
Somebody's cast-off, perhaps, given to him in his various situations.
There is one thing that is rather puzzling. No sign at all of his butler's kit.
Ah.
So he must have been wearing it when he did his vanishing act. Any man in his senses would have changed into an ordinary suit.
Yes, it is rather odd. Almost as if he hadn't gone at all. Now, the letters, the papers. Ah, a cutting about a cure for corns. A bottle of ink, no pen. And it doesn't look as if the blotter's going to tell us much.
No, it doesn't look as if he's used it at all.
That's rather odd, don't you think?
Well, how do you mean?
Well, chap usually writes letters.
Well, not if he's a criminal. Well, there's a splash of ink by the fireplace. Could be quite recent.
Oh, let me see.
It looks as if he dropped his fountain pen. But why should he drop it by the gas fire?
No, perhaps he threw it across the room. Fountain pens can be damned irritating.
What if...
Ed?
What if he was burning papers? Something like that.
Well, you don't burn papers on a gas fire. Hmm. But he might have been writing something at the table and suddenly heard somebody coming.
The police, perhaps?
Yes.
And he rushes over and shoves the papers under the gas fire and drops the fountain pen while he's doing it.
Sounds a bit far-fetched.
Well, why don't we see if there's anything behind the fire?
Right, I'll give it a try. Yes, there is something there, I think. Something white. Yeah, but I can't get at it. We want something like a woman's hatpin.
Well, we're not likely to find one in here. Well, there's a paper knife on the table. Here, see if we can get it with that.
Ah, thanks. Yep. It's coming. Got it. Looks as though you were right, Satterthwaite. Sheets of crumpled writing paper. Here.
Well, they seem to be drafts of the same letter. Listen to this. This is to say that the writer of this letter does not wish to cause unpleasantness about what he saw tonight. Now, he gave that up and tried again. John Ellis, butler, has certain facts concerning Sir Bartholomew's death in his possession. He has not yet given these facts to the police. And yet again. I know how Sir Bartholomew died. I haven't said anything to the police. If you will meet me... And it breaks off there. Presumably that was when he heard somebody coming.
Hmm. Well, it doesn't get us very far. If the fellow had only headed his effusions, sir or madam, it would have helped a bit.
At least one thing is clear. Ellis may have been a scoundrel, but he didn't murder Sir Bartholomew.
Was that why he slipped out in his butler's clothes? To meet the murderer?
I imagine he was paid to disappear.
I'm beginning to have a nasty suspicion that poor Ellis may well have disappeared for good. The man he went out to meet had already killed, twice.
And will probably have no compunction about doing so again.
So we may now be faced with a third murder. Come on, Satterthwaite, let's get out of this room. It's beginning to give me the shivers.
Sir Charles and his friend Mr. Satterthwaite had returned from their investigations at Melfort Abbey, the home of Sir Bartholomew Strange. Sir Charles knew that he could no longer avoid meeting the young woman with whom he had fallen in love and had fled to France to escape. Hermione Lytton Gore, known, very curiously, to her friends as Egg.
She can't very well come round here to my flat. Her mother mightn't like it. And I prefer to meet her at a restaurant. With you, of course, Satterthwaite.
Well, I'd be delighted. And then if we wanted to discuss our investigations more privately, we could adjourn to my house.
I knew you'd find out what really happened. That butler...
Ellis?
Obviously, he was killed because he knew too much.
But if that's the case, where is the body?
What about the secret passage? Miss Sutcliffe told me about it. The killer gave Ellis blackmail money and showed him how he could get out of the house without anyone seeing him, and then followed him down there and killed him.
There is one rather curious thing we couldn't get to the bottom of. According to the housekeeper, the night before the murder, Ellis took a telephone call about a Mrs. de Rushbridger. Tolly made rather a joke about it, asking Ellis if he'd got the name right. I thought at first it might be some sort of code.
But it wasn't. There really is a patient at the Melfort Abbey Sanatorium called Mrs. de Rushbridger, suffering from loss of memory.
That may well be significant, of course. But they wouldn't let us see her. And then there's young Oliver Manders.
What about him?
In the letter you wrote to me in France, you suggested he might be in trouble with the police. But in fact, they didn't seem in the least concerned about him.
It was silly of me. I thought that Oliver arriving at the Abbey the way he did might have been a trumped-up excuse.
And was it?
It was a bit fishy. His motorbike went into a wall on a perfectly straight stretch of road. And what was he doing up there, anyway?
He might have had his reasons. Quite natural ones.
Not at all.
Well, if our young friend is in no danger, where do I come in?
Oh, no, you're not going away again. You're going to stay here. We're going to find out the truth, you and I together.
And Satterthwaite?
Of course, and Mr. Satterthwaite.
Oh, yeah.
Right. First, we need to clarify the situation. Do we believe that the same person killed Babington and Bartholomew Strange?
Yes.
Do we believe that Tolly was murdered to prevent him revealing his suspicions?